reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, text 28. Yogan Tanustanad Ashuri Shaye Jnana Diptir Aguvek Kyati. Upon the destruction of impurities as a result of the practice of yoga, the lamp of knowledge arises. This culminates in discriminative discernment. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Tatsuran Mulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Yadati Sapadantikam Vancha Kopa Tarubhyascha Ripa Sindhu Vaivacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. Greetings from Sri Vrindavan Dham. Now, electricity went off. My phone is fully recharged, but the battery is weak. And sometimes it seems it lasts less than an hour. So if that happens, I'll let you know. So we're in the section called practice. The first chapter was meditative absorption. Question is how to get to that platform of meditation of absorption, the platform upon which the process of yoga is very, very effective. Yoga is not effective unless one is able to control his mind. That's what chitta vritti nirodha, that's what destroys the waves of fluctuations of the mind caused by passion and ignorance. The second chapter is dealing with the practice to get there. And it was described, a threefold practice, which we described somewhat in depth, of tapas, austerity, yaya, study, and Ishvara Pranidhan, giving one's life to God. And this process brings one to the samadhi because it will allow one to achieve the level of meditative absorption by removing the kleshas or the fundamental material conceptions. In this description of Kriya Yoga, it described the foundation of the material existence as the Purusha, or the living entity, the soul, identifying with the Prakriti, the mind and the body. And as long as the soul is focusing its consciousness on the mind and the body, rather than upon itself, for the purpose of worldly experience, one remains in the illusion that one is the mind and body, and therefore is tormented or suffers by the transformations of the mind and the body, which, although external to the soul, one identifies with as the self. So this concept that all suffering is actually external to one, it's due to some misconception that we're suffering and even feeling pain and so many things. The misconception is so deep that we actually feel pain as if it was happening to us, but it's not. And there are different examples of this. I sometimes give examples. Someone is watching a movie, and there's a romance, and they feel the kind of same feeling, but no, it's not a good example. We gave many examples before, the pot and the moon reflected in the water, etc. So this conjunction called samyog is caused by ignorance, and ignorance is destroyed by discriminative discernment at a very, very high level. I'm going to read it. It's described. If suffering is eliminated by the removal of its cause, ignorance, and this results in Purusha being established in one's own true nature, then what is the means to accomplish this? Asked Vyasa rhetorically. As he prepares to discuss the fourth aspect of the science of yoga, the means of liberation. The means indicated here by Patanjali is vivekhyati, discriminative discernment. Vivek, Vyas reiterates, is defined as the cognition of the distinction between buddhi and purusha. Again, buddhi is the mind, although it's sometimes said the intelligence, but it's the mental conception, and the soul. But as long as false knowledge is not be removed, discrimination remains shaky. False knowledge, began Bhikshu reminds us, consists of some scars of ignorance, avidya, which keep arising in the mind. So it's a samskara, an impression that I am the body, that sense gratification is the goal of life, that these things in relationship to the body are mine. The egotistical conception, self-centered conception, the equations. So this impression in the consciousness keeps on arising. I am the body. Sense gratification is the goal of life. And therefore, even when one has this positive samskara of discriminatory, I am not the body, I am the spirit soul, and that yehi samsparsha jabo god dukkha yoneya evite ayantavanta kontaya nitesha, that actually pleasure leads to suffering because it attaches you more to the body where suffering takes place. And even though you eke out a little pleasure, to eke out that pleasure, you've projected yourself in an identification which is full of suffering. Or maybe like someone who takes drugs, as a social example. To eke out that pleasure, he has to become dishonest. He has to come into the association of so many people that are bad associations. And so far, so a little pleasure, it creates this identification. When false knowledge becomes like a burned seed that is incapable of sprouting, or put differently, when the suts of the intelligence have been cleansed of the dirt of rajas, then cognition attains its utmost state of clarity. So it's covered by these false conceptions that keep on rising. But by the practice of yoga, it comes to a sense of clarity where this distinction becomes clear. Yes, that is not me, the body and the mind. I am the soul, and I'm a slave to that conception. And it's causing me, so it becomes so clear. Therefore, concludes Vyas, the path to liberation, namely the dissociation of Purusha from Buddhi, occurs when false knowledge is destroyed, like burned seed. Once this task is fully accomplished by practice and these samskaras become impotent, they can no longer arise. Then knowledge exerts control. In other words, discriminative discernment controls and eventually burns up the emergence of these unwanted impressions in the intelligence. And this discriminated discernment develops, initially awakened by listening to these sacred texts, strengthened by contemplation and the content, and pursued with reverence for a long time. Then this discrimination exposes and undermines one's attachment in the form of all kinds of desires. And then the last verse we discussed before this, then the yogi's true insight has these seven ultimate stages. And then it described that they're not progressive stages, they're just different perceptions of the same thing. And Professor Brian, he always reminds us that Anjali is not the creator of yoga. He's codifying a tradition into one particular school. Within the Indian spiritual landscape, there was much knowledge throughout different scriptures on the nature of the mind and the nature of meditation and the nature of discriminatory discernment. So he's putting it all together. That, for example, these are different realizations. That which is to be avoided, suffering is known, and there is nothing further to be known in this regard. The cause of this suffering has been completely eradicated, the causes of the kleshas, by the samadhi of restraint, in other words, yoga. The removal of the misidentification with Purusha with Buddhi becomes realized. So yoga is what? Restraining these samskaras by neglecting them. And by neglecting them, they start to recede. And the clarity of the mind and the perception becomes more and more pronounced and more realized. So it describes this. And now, today, we finally get into the limbs of yoga, which is classically called the Stanga Yoga. Which I think will make for a little bit more interesting a presentation, because it's a little bit more simple and practical. Because, you know, when you discuss yams and niyams, you're going to be discussing things like truthfulness and nonviolence, celibacy, and you'll get a flavor of the understanding of these different practical moral restraints and moral observations, and then discuss the rest of the yoga ladder in Ashtanga Yoga. So what here it's being saying is, upon the destruction of impurities as a result of the practice of yoga, the lamp of knowledge arises. This culminates in discriminated discernment. In other words, this samskara, this that will eventually rule of, I am not the body, I am the spirit soul. And sense gratification isn't the goal of life, at least that, as in Dvaita, as Professor Bryant, is also known as Dvaita, mentioned, he called it in his own language, the Terminator Samskara, that finishes all misconceptions and helps you come to a point of clarity. How many mistakes do we commit in ignorance? How many times do we just become covered and just do things that we really know are not beneficial to us? But because of ignorance, we don't see them clearly enough to kind of awaken us to what we know is actually the correct understanding. It happens to us all so much. But when you come to a point of clarity, you're more challenged by reality and by truth. In ignorance, we just become lazy, and rationalization sets forward. And you know, okay, I'll do this. And we don't come to the platform of Buddhi and understanding. So I had to come to this real platform of clarity where the, even a Sanskrit term for this, what is it? Vasikara Samkhya, which means knowledge that exerts control. When discriminative discernment controls and is able to burn up the emergence of any of these samskaras or imprints for perception and action that will torment us under the illusion that it will benefit us. So, and how do you get there? Now he's going to describe this Ashtanga Yoga. Now, Professor Bryant discusses something that this actually seems abrupt, because he was discussing Kriya Yoga, which is a threefold process, tapas, Swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhan, and now all of a sudden there is an eightfold process in which these three things are part of the niyams, or moral restraints, right? There's moral observances. I should not be violent. I should not steal. I should be truthful. I should be renounced. So these are the yamas. And in the niyams, these are these moral observances. These moral observances, three of them are given in Kriya Yoga. So it seems to be almost a kind of like a completely different thing being discussed here with no link. So sometimes they say maybe it's a continuity of the text. But Professor Bryant discusses that you have to be very careful of saying that, because this cryptic style of writing sutras may not submit to the modern notions of structural coherence. Because it's assuming they're written because they have to codify the knowledge and put them into so many short cryptic phrases, there's a great assumption of the frame of reference of the audience at the time. And the audience perhaps understands that there's different ways of seeing the same thing. So he's drawing actually on different traditions. And in those different traditions, in other words, the point here is the same as with Kriya Yoga. This Ashtanga Yoga, this Eightfold Limb, it's the same. How do you get to that point of meditative absorption, which culminates in this discriminative discernment that allows you to use the instrument of the mind for the second purpose of the seeing or matter, which is liberation? How do you get to that point? So it's the same thing. Because this Vivek, this discernment, will destroy ignorance. And ignorance is the cause of this bondage and identification, which is the cause of all suffering. So how do you get to this point of Vivek, this powerful discrimination that subdues any type of mental imprints connected with ignorance? It allows the shining light of goodness to illuminate, enable one to see clearly. How do you get to that point? Well, now he's going to give another process. Here, there's an eight-limb thing, a stage, an eight-limb process of attaining discriminative discernment, and it's the practice of the eight limbs of yoga called here Yoganag Hanu Nastinam. And this, they'll discuss these eight limbs for the rest of the chapter. And then he describes here, by this practice, you all subdue passion and ignorance and impurities. So, and when that impurity is removed, then the light of full knowledge, called here Jnana Deepta, a light of knowledge, will shine forth like the sun. And at that time, the impurities of ignorance and passion, they'll dwindle, and the clarity and luminosity inherent in goodness can manifest without any impediment. The more, he's saying, this eightfold path is practiced, the more these impurities dwindle. I'm reading now. And the more they dwindle, the more this light can correspondingly increase. And this will result in the desired discrimination. And it gives an example, just as axe slices with a tree, by the practice of these limbs, the impurities of the chitta, or the material mind, are chipped away, and when they're chipped away, the mind itself becomes an instrument, just like an axe. You may want to create like a spear so that it'll have a particular effect. So, you know, you chip away and you chip away and you chip away and you chip away, and then it becomes what you want. So it's like that, although the concept here is more like there is an instrument that has a great, tremendous value, because the instrument allows you clarity of thought and discrimination, but somehow it's covered with something that's caked on. So how do you get rid of it? Well, you have to adopt this Ashtanga Yoga practice. Now we'll go on to those different limbs. So they're mentioned here. Yama, niyama, asana, pranayam, pratyahara, dharana, dhyan, samadayo, stavangani. So, astangani, these eight limbs are what? Yam, abstentions. How you controlling what you do. Especially how you deal with others. Then niyam, observances, how you deal with yourself. Then asana is his posture. Then pranayama is breath control. Then pratyahara is withdrawal of the senses. Dharana is concentration. Dhyana is meditation. And samadhi is called complete absorption. I'm going to read a little bit. In 112, because it mentioned how do you practice yoga by, you know, practice and detachment. And this practice were presented as the means to control the vrittis and attain samadhi. And in 2.1, self-discipline. Study and submission to the Lord. Self-discipline study were identified as practice conducive to eliminating the kleshas, obstacles to yoga, and attaining samadhi. The following sutra offers further prescriptions for attaining the goal. So it mentioned just three things. And these three things are part of niyam, and there's two more niyams and moral observances. Plus there's yamas, there's moral restraints. Plus there's asanas, etc. You're saying a lot more now is being given. Actually, both set of injunctions in 121 and 21 can be located within the first two limbs. The yamas, abstentions, and niyamas, observances. And so this is going to be a more elaborate practice of observances and restraints to purify the mind of its coverings and bring it to samadhi. So he says it's more elaborate here. And one commentator says, Shankar also asks that there are other requirements on the path, such as practicing dharma, righteous conduct, and accepting a guru. So these are going to be discussed. And this concept of calling them ungas or limbs, that was already commonly in place. A goal is dependent on different parts. Anga generally means limbs. And Angi means the possessor of the limbs of the body. So there's different Angas. There's limbs of this yoga, different parts of this yoga that will bring you to perfection. So this is, the yamas are, now they list first the yamas. These are moral restraints, abstentions. Basically, mostly having to deal with others. But basically, they're moral restraints. They're the regulations. There's rules and regulations. These are the regulations. The yamas are nonviolence, truthfulness, refraining from stealing, celibacy, and renunciation of unnecessary perceptions. So ahimsa is discussed first, and it's the most important one. Therefore, to be an accomplished yogi, it remains limited unless you have some moral restraints, and according to Patanjali. And therefore, Prabhupada, in his criticism of yoga practice, when it's just given as postures, but there are postures, but no principle. So there are principles, and as yoga means to control the mind, and it's a progressive process. You know, you can't. It's like a building without a foundation. So the foundation of controlling the mind is how you deal with others. If you're uncontrolled to the extent that you will commit violence to others, that you're just a pathological liar, that you covet another's possessions, that you can't control properly your sexual urge, and that you're endlessly accumulating things, then what is the question of meditation? What is the question of actually getting to the point of discriminative discernment? So, of all the yamas, the commentators say that nonviolence is the root of other yamas, because all the other restraints are based on not exploiting others. So the basis of it is, and therefore, if there is a conflict between yamas, then ahimsa remains supreme. For example, you should be truthful, and he describes what truthful means. Your words must be consistent with your knowledge. That you've, when you ascertain something to be true, then your words have to represent what you ascertain to be true. You have to be truthful. But what if someone, the hypothetical example comes, what if someone comes and let's say it's, you know, World War II, and some Dutch family is hiding some Jews, and, you know, and the Nazis come and say, "Did you see these people here?" And on the, what do you do? Well, you have to lie, because it will cause nonviolence. It will cause violence. So ahimsa, if there's ever ahimsa, rules supreme. And he goes so far, according to Voss, the goal of all the other yamas is to achieve nonviolence and enhance it. Because without that sense of controlling your exploitation, it makes sense. Because what's false ego? The false conception is I am the enjoyer and I am the controller. And one tries to do that both in his actions and in his self-conception. And that leads to competition. When you have those desires to enjoy, and to enjoy more than others, then it leads to a type of competition. And that type of competition leads to harm. You're wishing others, you develop malice towards those who are your competitors. So as long as you have that materialistic conception and keep yourself and your desires in the center, then there's malice, and there's envy, there's hatred of people who are better. So the material, the basic material conception is competition and hatred. And, real ahimsa means to even control the ill will towards others. Unless you control that, you are in material consciousness. And all other moral restraints are to free you from that sense of undue competition and envy. When in the second verse of the Bhagavad, Dharma Projita Kaitavotra Paramo Namatsaranam Sittam, that what a spiritualist is one Namatsara. He's free from envy. And what does that mean? He's free from that conception that I should be the center, have more, enjoy more than others. So that's what a spiritual is. He gets rid of that conception. Getting rid of that conception, the foundation of it, is nonviolence. So now he's going to discuss a little bit about this nonviolence, and it's interesting. He says, he describes that, how do you become nonviolent? Because when you perform your duty, it's impossible to avoid harming other living entities, such as bacteria, insects, when cooking, cleaning, bathing. But Vyasa says, nevertheless, one must strive as far as possible to avoid harming even an insect. So see really what yoga is, the level of morality that is demanded, and such a connection between moral principles, such a connection between... my phone is going out real quick, I can see that. There's such a connection between moral principles and nonviolence and control of the mind. And therefore, what to speak about meat eating and trying to be a yogi when you're feasting on the flesh of other living entities, completely against yoga. So, Manu says, to protect living entities, one should inspect the ground constantly as one walks by night and day because of the risk of grievous bodily harm. So on this path of yoga, one is really, really cultivating that. Very interesting commentary by Professor Bryant on the Jain community, which is a religion that takes nonviolence almost to the ultimate degree. And even the greatest of their monks fast to death because they sacrificed their own life because life is just violent. They do not cook after sunset, since insects would be attracted by the flames of fire. They strain their water to remove any microscopic creatures that might fall in, etc. Sometimes even wear gauze over their mouths. They sweep before to not step on anything. So that's taking it, without making value judgment on that right now, taking it to the utmost level, or the extreme level. But the principle is to become nonviolent. Of course, in a theistic, a pure theistic conception, if one is not surrendered to God, at the root, the real root of envy has to do with the lack of surrender to God and of enmity of that superiority. And that if you become completely nonviolent, you ultimately would have to confront that of being satisfied with the superiority of the divine. And really, very interesting, some of you know Borijan. I went to Gobradon with him, and very fortunate he stayed at my place there. And a very wonderful day. We spent the afternoon with Gopi Pranadana, all Shastavachar, all discussing different Shastra points. But one thing was very interesting is that if the goal of a theistic process is complete dependence on God and surrender to God, Borijan quoted from Srila Sridhar Maharaj when he was discussing the gopis who gave up everything, and he started quoting some of their conceptions, and you know, he said, oh, how horrible, because from the material conception, that degree of dependence and giving up one's self-importance. So the theistic conception, very difficult to surrender. And that's really the entrance to the path of bhakti. And very difficult to surrender. So Borja made a very interesting point. The path of bhakti, the surrender is not based on discriminative discernment as much as it's based as on love and attraction. That's why bhakti yoga, of all yogis want to worship me with faith and devotion is the highest of all. Because to cross into that realm of giving up the egoistic conception, to do it when you're in this embodied condition and when you've already accepted the body on the basis of worldly experience, which is the basis of ahimsa and the basis of violence and competition, and then to have to do it by the power of discriminative discernment, where bhakti cultivates an attraction out of love for the divine, one will move out of the center and be willing to see oneself as an object rather than as the subject. We want to be the subject. We want to see everything else as the object of our desires. So to become the object rather than being the subject, how painful in materialistic conception. And not only becoming the object of God, which means becoming the object of everything. To the extent that one sees everything else as guru, and sees oneself as the only disciple. How difficult. So that's by attraction. He makes a point that the level that the chains undertake is not recommended by the commentators, but at least eating meat is to be shunned by anyone with even the minimum pretensions of aspiring to be a practicing yogi as understood by Patanjali. And it goes further with nonviolence that a person who's empathetic, compassionate towards others would never think of inflicting violence on others. They understand the karmic consequences the ignorance that will cover their conscience. If yoga is coming to a platform of pure goodness, what is the effect of the senseless violence on innocent creatures, how much that will create the vibration of covering consciousness. To be able to do that without sensitivity, how much your consciousness will have to be covered and brought away from the platform of yoga. And Parinamananda says further that it also encompasses giving up the spirit of malice and hatred, because these produce the tendency to harm others. And it includes violence in the form of harsh words or causing fear in others. Ahimsa must be followed in thought, deed, and word, says Shankara. The degree of violence is determined by the intent. Acts of violence performed without malice and hatred, for example, self-defense, is not the same as murdering someone in cold blood. But the yogis avoid retaliating even in self-defense against an attacker, and will shoo off even a snake rather than kill it, and thus attempt to inflict as little harm as possible. Now, because I do believe that my phone is going to go off pretty soon, would anybody like to say hello? I just got to get a new battery. I'm restricted to like 45 minutes on this.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Govardhan?
Yes, Maharaj.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Okay. I should be back in, my plan is to be back in America on the end of February. So I'll see what we can do there. Anybody else? Who's that? Anybody else like to say hello? Questions?
Did you say questions?
I said, is Gail there?
Hi, Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Gail. The battery may go out. That's why I'm hesitant. It'll be frustrating. But what questions you have, Gail?
Well, so many. But anyway, one is I was wondering if, you know, if you are in the midst of some very heavy physical or emotional pain,
yeah,
and you are unable to conceive how this pain is not actually happening to yourself, you know. It feels like it's happening to your real self. I was wondering if,
yeah,
if by merely remembering on an intellectual level that I am not this body, will that have any purifying effect that brings me closer to experiencing the fact that I'm actually not this body? Or is it only chanting Hare Krishna that achieves that?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is actually going to be discussed later on, but I would say one thing here that, there's practices that move you forward, obviously, and give you more discernment, and, you know, let you, you know, understand that, you know, even these aversions that one has, you know what the basis of them are. They're actually based on the desire to have worldly experience and the misconceptions that you have, etc. But the Yoga Sutras, the battery is going to go out in a second, but the Yoga Sutras, we're going to discuss this, it doesn't discount psychology and up trying to uproot, it's going to go off really soon, uproot some of those samskaras by the psychological process of superimposing other ones on it. So it doesn't discount psychology as a help to get over particular deep impressions that are degrading the consciousness. So there's psychology, there's knowledge, there's devotion, there, you know, there's all ways. But, you know, in the process of bhakti, you get right at the root. The root of all the problem is the lack of surrender to the divine, which projects one into this kind of world of worldly experience. And, you know, you realize that your own hatred and enmity is there in the heart, and therefore you're having to face it externally from others. So, I mean, there's different ways to get out of it, but it does not negate psychology. And that's going to be coming up in this. What if you do, if there's powerful samskaras of ignorance? Is there anything else you can do? Well, yes. You can superimpose upon those samskaras, opposing samskaras, that help you to subdue those. There's an attachment for drinking, but then you put in the samskara for the result